how important to you nonviolence is in relation to anarchist change, and in terms of what this book is about, learning.
Yep. You know, Tolstoy is an interesting character. You know, he actually quit being a novelist because his to paraphrase the line, he said, I can't tear myself away from real creatures for the world of imaginary creatures. And he quit being a novelist because he started an alternative school called Yasnaya Polyana in the Urals, and it ended up being a chain of like 14 schools that he founded in a alternative education publication and a whole thing. It's a totally interesting story if you get a chance to check it out further. He wrote a great book called On Education. And much of it is, to me, is so interesting because he's right in the middle of it and he's trying to figure it out. He's so not dogmatic. He's trying to figure out how you treat a kid when a kid doesn't want to listen to you. How do you treat a kid when he stands up and throws a book in class? What happens? How do you think about that? And he really thinks it through in a very transparent and, I think, kind of charming way. To get to your question about nonviolence, I can't say that I have much opinion about nonviolence per se. I'm not a proponent of nonviolence, but I'm not a proponent of nonviolence either. I think that nonviolent civil disobedience and resistance is a very plausible tool for social change, and I also think that as a dogmatism, I think it's suspect. I think that that a whole variety, some people might call that a diversity of tactics, should be on the table when we think about social change. And I think the same way when I think about education, or I think about learning, or I think about how to raise kids, I think that we should have an open mind about all the possibilities, and really take the question, what does it mean for kids to thrive? What does it mean for our kids to thrive? What does it mean for our neighbors' kids to thrive? What does it mean for the kids, you know, throughout our community to thrive? I think that we have to think about that as broadly as possible and look to all kinds of options, not dogmatically. And I think that in terms of social change, too, and I think of that in terms specifically of anarchist social change. So I think that nonviolence as a practice has, I think, a lot of deep meaning and some real successes. And I think that as a dogmatism, I don't think it's useful.
Thank you. Hey, I don't know if you have a copy of your book nearby. If you do, I wonder if you'd be willing to read a paragraph. I don't know if you have it.
You know, so sorry, I don't.
No,
I'd be happy for you to read a paragraph.
Yeah, that's fine. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you. It's been terrific. And this is from John Holt, and it was published in his book Freedom and Beyond. And it's just a little vignette that presents the view of our education system from the outside. He says, imagine that I am traveling into the future in a time capsule and that I come to rest 500 years from now in an intelligent, humane, and life-enhancing civilization. One of the people who lives there comes to meet me, to guide me, and to explain his society. At some point, after he has shown me where people live, work, and play, I ask him, but where are your schools? Schools? What are schools? He replies, schools are where people go to learn things. I do not understand, he says. People learn things everywhere, in all places. I know that, I say, but a school is a special place where there are special people who teach you things, help you learn things. I'm sorry, but I still don't understand. Everyone helps other people to learn things. Anyone who knows something or can do something can help someone else who wants to learn more about it. Why should there be special people to do it? And try as I will, I cannot make clear to him why we think education should be, must be, separate from the rest of life.
Perfect. Lovely. John Holt, so good.
Matt Hearn, you can check out more about Matt's writings, other interviews, and his books at mightymatthearn.com. It's mighty, M-A-T-T-H-E-R-N.com. And thank you, Matt, for speaking with me this evening, and thank you for putting together Everywhere All the Time, the Deschooling Reader. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jim.
Okay, enjoy yourself. Good night.
Take care. Thank you.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. That's a show with me for the next 2 hours. I'm Robert Norse, and welcome. Stay tuned if you'd like. We'll be having an interview briefly, an update from Orlando, Florida, on the latest adventures of Orlando Food Not Bombs and the web of Mayor Buddy John Dyer, who seems intent on arresting Food Not Bombs volunteers, but maybe we have some updates there on the latest. Stay tuned.
He was raised in Gifu, on the islands of Japan. He was sent off to Manchuria. That's how this tale began. For his next assignment in the diplomatic corps was far off Lithuania and the European war. My grandfather was from Krakow. The Nazis came, he fled. He took his family to Vilnius so they might not end up dead. But the panzers were advancing, and he knew they had to go. But he had to have a visa, and all the embassies said no. There was only one final possibility. The last consulate left open, the Third Reich's Asian ally. There in Lithuania, there was no time to lose. They came asking for a visa, thousands of Polish Jews. The diplomat called Tokyo, can I grant them this reprieve? 3 times he got his answer, tell them all to leave. He looked into their eyes, talked to his family. He and his wife decided, we must set these people free. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son. Disobeying orders that they knew to be wrong, Senpo and Yukiko started writing all day long. A month's worth of visas in every 20-hour day. Senpo and Yukiko could turn no refugee away. Word came from the empire, it's time to turn it in. You're closing down your consulate and moving to Berlin. They knew they did the right thing, of this they had no doubt. They threw visas through the window as their train pulled out. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son. My grandfather crossed Siberia for 5 times the normal cost, fearing for the future with every minute lost. He got the ferry to Kobe, then to occupied Shanghai. There he spent the war years while back home his people died. Sugihara-san did not seek praise from anyone. When he died, the papers said, his neighbors knew not what he'd done. But there are 40,000 people living lives today. Without Senpo Sugihara, I'd not be here now to say. Although I never met him, when all is said and done, I am Sugihara's son. Thank you.
And that was another one from David Rovick's collection, Troubadour, People's History and Song. And it was about Sugihara's visas. And Rovick's writes, Hitler's forces were quickly taking over most of Europe, and millions of European Jews were desperately trying to escape. No one wanted them, including Britain and the U.S., which were both turning away hundreds of or boatloads of Jewish refugees and effectively sentencing them to death. Poland had been conquered, and thousands of Polish Jews had managed to get as far as Lithuania. The German army was quickly advancing across Eastern Europe, and they would soon enter Lithuania. In order to get permission from the Soviet authorities to travel across the USSR and get out of Europe that way, about the only action available, the refugees needed a visa showing they were traveling across Siberia in order to transit to another country. Effectively, that meant they needed a visa from the Empire of Japan, Nazi Germany's erstwhile ally in the Pacific. It has long been popular to stereotype Japanese people as unimaginative and obedient followers of the status quo. A serious reading of Japanese history will provide us with a rich tapestry of, looks like reality, a little hard to read this, however, along with the fanatical emperor worshippers and corporate drones we've already heard about far too much. When Senpo and Yukikyo Sugihara looked out from their diplomatic residence in Lithuania at the desperate faces of Jewish refugees outside their home, begging them for a visa to get out of Europe, the diplomat called Tokyo and received clear orders not to help the Jews. Fully conscious that they had no idea what the consequences might be for their livelihoods or even their lives, Senpo Sugihara and his wife, Yukiko, decided they must help these people at whatever the cost. For a month, with barely any interruption for food or sleep, Senpo and Yukiko worked day and night, filling out thousands of visas. Each visa was good for a family, so it is estimated that they saved the lives of 10,000 Jews, who now represent a population of 40,000 descendants, including my friend, that's David Rovick's friend, Ben Mansiki of Madison, Wisconsin. And then you just heard his song, Sugihara. And that's, again, from his album, Troubadour, People's History in Song. So welcome to another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. As mentioned earlier, I'm going to be, I assume, hearing from Ben Markison, who's was one of the first people arrested in Orlando, Florida, back in early June for serving Food Not Bombs food to homeless people, poor people, hungry people, and just anybody in Lake Eola Park without a permit, as now required by a city ordinance cooked up, most people agree, to get rid of visible homeless people present, and particularly to get rid of Food Not Bombs. And it's an interesting, been an interesting series of interviews I had with both him and with the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry. It seems that usually I bring on Food Not Bombs people when they're in trouble, rather than most of the time. Food Not Bombs simply presses on, providing food and support at political protests, doing regular vegan cooking in different cities across the country and across the world. But I'm particularly concerned when they're attacked by authorities, because that kind of becomes the friction point where the rubber meets the road, as they say in the cliche, and one where we want to be supportive of the continued operation of organizations like Food Not Bombs. In Santa Cruz, I understand a Huff member, Casey Livengood, is trying to start a Food Not Bombs, and actually did, almost entirely on his own initiative, along with activist Crow, who is, he and the two of them also were almost single-handedly carried forth a protest for 2 weeks in front of the county building demanding that Gary Johnson and Attorney Ed Fry of Peace Camp 2010, the homeless protest, sentenced to 6 months in jail, be freed pending appeal. They had been sentenced to 6 months and then denied any kind of bail unless they paid $50,000 each. And that was publicized by Crow and by Casey and by others, and that resulted ultimately in drawing public attention to them. And attorney Peter Leeming went into the court and was able to, after researching and realizing that the judge suddenly became aware it was in a rather embarrassing position, that was Judge John Gallagher, reduced the bail from $50,000 to $110. So they both got out, or at least pending their appeal, which I fear will be turned down, but at least for that period of time, they're going to be free to do what they need to do, make arrangements they need to make, and maybe raise the issue further of this absurd anti-homeless law and series of police practices that they are fighting, which is both the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, which makes it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night in the city limits, and the broader statewide 647E ordinance, a penal code which is used generally by authorities to stop political protests on public property that's usually designed for public gatherings like the state capitol or parks in front of City Hall, or in this case, the steps of the courthouse, where you would expect to find people protesting. But it's also used occasionally just to go after homeless people who are not in the city, and so they're not under the jurisdiction of the sleeping ban. The interesting thing about the Peace Camp 2010 protests, which happened for 3 months last year and are still going through court, Linda LeMaster goes to court in early August for her trial, again facing up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. The interesting thing about these prosecutions is there was an ordinance that could be used that was in the city, the sleeping ban ordinance, which the protesters sort of expected would be used against them, but the county authorities decided not to use it. I think they had various different excuses they used. The main one seemed to be some kind of disconnect with the Santa Cruz Police Department or jurisdictional dispute. It's not been made clear to me why we weren't arrested on the first 4 or 5 days when we were sleeping out there, and I was one of those who was initially sleeping out in front of the courts in a protest that began on July 4th, 2010, and lasted until early September of that year, although it was driven away from the county building after about a month by arrests and threats, moved to City Hall, and then the arrests and threats continued, this time from the city authorities, and there they were using both the sleeping ban and also other laws that were conveniently dragged out, dusted off, or cooked up for the occasion. Currently, as the rumor has it, there is a deal being proposed to Ed Fry, the attorney, who is facing a year in jail. He isn't facing a year in jail. He was sentenced to not a year in jail. And he has been offered, as I understand it, in a sort of a backroom deal, an opportunity to avoid that if he wants to sever his case from that of Gary and the other defendants. And he didn't seem to be too happy with that proposal, to his credit, concerned about solidarity with other activists and also changes in the law, which was the whole point of this protest originally last year, to change the law that criminalizes homeless people at night doing what they have to do in a city that has shelter for, 46 people in the Paul Lee loft every night of 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people out there. It's a complete farce that there is some kind of reasonable shelter, and that's why it really is disgusting to see the DA mendaciously presenting testimony and wasting public money to create the misimpression that there somehow were alternatives for these folks who were dragged into court and ultimately convicted of, quote, illegal lodging, which surely meant sleeping, because that's actually how Judge Gallagher, the judge who oversaw the trial in Department 2, defined lodging. He said it's sleeping. So you fall asleep anywhere in the state, then in theory, according to Gallagher's logic, if a cop comes along and tells you to move or demands you prove you had permission to be there, then you need to, if you don't leave that particular place, although where you can go, I don't know, if you don't happen to have a private place to go, you are guilty of a crime punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine, to wit, Penal Code 647E, illegal lodging. So, should be hearing shortly from Ben Markison, who is, again, as I told you, in Orlando, Florida. I'm not sure if he's a native or simply a resident there. He certainly is an activist there with the group Food Not Bombs, which has been serving for years there. And the city tried to stop them with an ordinance that the jury refused to convict under, and the lower courts threw out. But an en banc panel of the circuit courts there found it was constitutional and rather tortured reasoning. And so the city said, oh, this is that. We're going to enforce it. Came back, enforced it, and the Food Not Bombs said, as they said in some other jurisdictions like Santa Cruz and San Francisco 20 years ago, enforce it all you want. We're going to keep doing what we need to do to feed poor and homeless people and to get across the very important message, food, not bombs. Time to change the national priorities and the local priorities, for that matter. You know, respect, not repression, if you will. So we're going to hear the update from Ben, who kind of gave me a preview when I spoke to him earlier today. I don't want to, you know, spoil the surprise. I'm kind of waiting till he shows up. And I think while I'm doing that, while we're doing that waiting, let's listen to another tune from David Rovix and his Troubadour album. And this one is it's called Song for Hugh Thompson.
Hugh Thompson was a pilot, just like many more, fighting for old glory on a far-off foreign shore. He was on a lethal mission, only one of many, following his orders to kill the enemy, to kill the enemy. He flew low above the village, searching for the foe. When he saw a wounded child on the path below, he thought this to be a sure sign that the enemy was near. So he radioed for backup, and more choppers did appear. More choppers did appear. Wounded, he cried out, and beware of an attack. And then the child died by a bullet through her back. And when he looked around for the culprits of the scene, it was a company of men in U.S. military green. U.S. military green. The dead were in the hundreds, strewn all around, in this place called My Lai, which once had been a town. There was a hut of huddled children, soldiers had them in their sights. Hugh decided at that moment to fight for what was right, to fight for what was right. Weapons on the GIs, and his copter crews obeyed, and stood among the children, tattered and afraid. The whole town had been murdered, but for some kids and widowed wives, and Hugh Thompson made sure that those remaining would survive, that those remaining would survive. It was a 15-minute standoff in a knee-deep sea of red. Amidst the moaning of the dying and the silence of the dead, Hugh Thompson was a soldier and he served his country well. On the day he saved the lives of a dozen kids in hell. Of a dozen kids in hell. Thank you.
And that was Song for Hugh Thompson. Again, another one by David Rovix. I'm looking up his Hugh Thompson Jr. bio on Wikipedia. And what I find is he lived from 1943 to 2006. He's described as a U.S. Army helicopter pilot during the Vietnam War, most well known for his role in stopping the My Lai massacre, in which a group of U.S. Army soldiers tortured and killed several hundred unarmed Vietnamese civilians, mutilating their bodies after they had been murdered. Thompson and his crew, Glenn Andriotta and Lawrence Colburn, were recognized many years later for their heroism at My Lai. Andriotta died in combat 3 weeks after the massacre and so was honored posthumously. This is all on Wikipedia if you want to check it out. In the early morning of March 16, 1968, Thompson's OH-23 encountered no enemy fire over My Lai 4. Spotting two possible Viet Cong suspects, he forced the Vietnamese men to surrender and flew them off for a tactical interrogation. Thompson also marked the location of several wounded Vietnamese with green smoke, a signal that they needed help. Returning to the My Lai area at around 900 after refueling, he noticed that the people he had marked were now dead, out in a paddy field beside a dike 200 meters, 660 feet south of the village. He marked the location of a wounded young Vietnamese woman. Thompson and his crew watched from a low hover as Captain Ernest Medina, the commanding officer of C Company 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment, came up to the woman, prodded her with his foot, and then shot and killed her. Thompson then flew over an irrigation ditch filled with dozens of bodies. Shocked at the sight, he radioed his accompanying gunships, knowing his transmission would be monitored by many on the radio net, saying, "It looks to me like there's an awful lot of unnecessary killing going on down there. Something ain't right about this. There's bodies everywhere. There's a ditch full of bodies that we saw. There's something wrong here." Movement from the ditch indicated to Thompson that there were still people alive there. Thompson landed his helicopter and dismounted. David Mitchell, a sergeant and squad leader in 1st Platoon C Company, walked over to him. When asked by Thompson whether any help can be provided to the people in the ditch, the sergeant replied that the only way to help them was to put them out of their misery. Second Lieutenant William Calley, there's a famous name, commanding officer of the 1st Platoon C Company, then came up and the two had the following conversation. "Thompson, what's going on there, Lieutenant?" "Calley, this is my business." "Thompson, what is this? Who are these people?" "Calley, just following orders." "Thompson, orders? Whose orders?" "Calley, just following Thompson." "But these are human beings, unarmed civilians, sir." "Calley, look, Thompson, this is my show. I'm in charge. It ain't your concern." "Thompson, yeah, great job." "Calley, you better get back in that chopper and mind your own business." "Thompson, you ain't heard the last of this." Thompson took off again, and Andriotta reported that Mitchell was now executing the people in the ditch. Furious, Thompson flew over the northeast corner of the village and spotted a group of about 10 civilians, including children, running towards a homemade bomb shelter. Pursuing them were soldiers from the 2nd Platoon C Company. Realizing that the soldiers intended to murder the Vietnamese, Thompson landed his aircraft between them and the villagers. Thompson turned to Colburn and Andriotta and told them that if the Americans began shooting at the villagers or him, they should open fire their M-60 machine guns at the Americans. "Y'all cover me. If these bastards open up on me or these people, you open up on them. Promise me." He then dismounted to confront the 2nd Platoon's leader, Stephen Brooks. Thompson told him he wanted help getting the peasants out of the bunker. "Thompson, hey, listen, hold your fire. I'm going to try to get these people out of this bunker. Just hold your men here." Brooks, "Yeah, we can help you get them out of the bunker with a hand grenade." "Thompson, just hold your men here. I think I can do better than that." Brooks declined to argue with him, even though a commissioned officer, he outranked Thompson. After coaxing the 11 Vietnamese out of the bunker, Thompson persuaded the pilots of two UH-1 Huey gunships, Dan Millens and Brian Livingstone, flying as his escort, to evacuate them. While Thompson was returning to base to refuel, Andriotta spotted movement in an irrigation ditch filled with approximately 100 bodies. The helicopter again landed, and the men dismounted to search for survivors. After wading through the remains of the dead and dying men, women, and children, Andriotta extracted a live boy named Bo Da. Thompson flew the survivor to the ARVN hospital in Quang Nhi. Upon returning to their base about 1100, Thompson heatedly reported the massacre to his superiors. His allegations of civilian killings reached Lieutenant Colonel Frank Barker, the operation's overall commander. Barker radioed his executive officer to find out from Captain Medina what was happening on the ground. Medina then gave the ceasefire order to Charlie Company to, quote, knock off the killing. After the massacre, Thompson made an official report of the killings and was even interviewed by Colonel Orrin Henderson, the commander of 11th Infantry Brigade, the parent organization of the 20th Infantry. Concerned, senior American officers canceled several planned operations by Task Force Barker against other villages, My Lai 5, My Lai 1, etc., in Quang Nai province, possibly preventing the additional massacre of hundreds, if not thousands, of Vietnamese civilians. Initially, commanders thought the Americans' chain of command were successful in covering up the My Lai massacre. Somewhat perversely, Thompson received the Distinguished Flying Cross for his actions at My Lai. The citation for the award fabricated events and praised Thompson for taking to a hospital a Vietnamese child caught in an intense crossfire and said that, quote, his sound judgment had greatly enhanced Vietnamese-American relations in the operational area. Thompson threw the citation away. Thompson continued to fly observation missions in the OH-23 Raven and was hit by enemy fire a total of 8 times. In 4 of those instances, his aircraft was lost. In the last incident, his helicopter was brought down by enemy machine gun fire, and he broke his back in the resulting crash landing. This ended his combat career in Vietnam, and he was evacuated to a hospital in Japan and began a long period of rehabilitation. He carried psychological scars from his service in Vietnam for the rest of his life. When news of the massacre publicly broke, Thompson repeated his account to then-Colonel William Wilson and then-Lieutenant General William Pierce during their official Pentagon investigations. In late 1969, Thompson was summoned to Washington, D.C. and appeared before a special closed hearing of the House Armed Services Committee. There, he was sharply criticized by congressmen, in particular Chairman Mendel Rivers, Democrat of South Carolina, who were anxious to play down allegations of a massacre by American troops. Rivers publicly stated that he felt Thompson was the only soldier at My Lai who should be punished for turning his weapons on fellow American troops and unsuccessfully attempted to have him court-martialed. As word of his actions became publicly known, Thompson started receiving hate mail, death threats, and mutilated animals on his doorstep. After his Vietnam service, Thompson was assigned to Fort Rucker, Alabama, to become an instructor pilot and later got his direct commission. His other military assignments included Fort Jackson, South Carolina, Korea, Fort Ord, California, Fort Hood, Texas, and bases in Hawaii. He retired from the Army in the rank of Major in 1983. Thompson became a helicopter pilot for the oil industry after leaving the military, operating in the Gulf of Mexico. In 1988, an English documentary film producer, Michael Bilton, working for Yorkshire Television, managed to contact him via his mother, who was then widowed and living in Texas. At that point, Thompson had all but disappeared off the radar. Bilton had been talking with his former crew member, Larry Colburn, and put the two in touch with each other after a gap of nearly 16 years. Both Thompson and Colburn had been trying to find each other without success. Thompson was living in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Colburn near Atlanta, Georgia, and they quickly arranged a reunion. Bilton flew down and spent a long weekend with Thompson discussing the events at My Lai. It proved the beginning of a long friendship, which lasted until Thompson's death. Both Thompson and Colburn agreed to be interviewed for the film 4 Hours in My Lai, 1989, also known as Remember My Lai, for PBS in the U.S., which went on to win a British Academy Award and an International Emmy. The interview showed Thompson overcome with grief at what he had witnessed at My Lai and his sense of powerlessness of being able to prevent it happening. "Here we were supposed to be the guys in the white hats. It upset me." Bilton and his colleague Kevin Sim then began researching a book, and Bilton concluded further interviews with Thompson and Colburn. When the book 4 Hours in My Lai, 1992, was published, it prompted a campaign to have the heroism of Thompson and his helicopter crew recognized. Several senior figures in the U.S. military supported the campaign, as did President H.W. Bush. Thompson and Colburn were invited to speak to a wide range of audiences about the ethics of warfare and so forth and so on. Exactly 30 years after the massacre, Thompson, Andreotta, and Colburn were awarded the Soldier's Medal, the United States Army's highest award for bravery not involving direct contact with the enemy. Of course, he was in direct contact with the enemy, in this case, the U.S. Army. The United States Army's highest award for bravery, and not involving, I said that before, was the ability to do the right thing, even at the risk of their personal safety, that guided these soldiers to do what they did, and so forth. I think I went on too long about that, but, of course, this should bring to mind very quickly what was revealed by WikiLeaks, and some say by Bradley Manning, in the collateral murder video that was released last year and took place in 2007, where U.S. helicopters gunned down journalists and children on the ground in Iraq. And, of course, as far as I know, it suffered no consequences for it, except, of course, that Assange is under house arrest and Manning has been in close confinement for almost a year now, currently in Leavenworth. So we're in trouble. We're essentially in the middle of a continuing me lie, and what a lie it is. And it's going on day after day, night after night, week after week, month after month. And, of course, the irony is that it's being funded with the blood of the American people, because every penny that's taken away to fund the fancy technology and machinery that's murdering people with drones overseas is taken away from, as the dim but occasionally on-target President Dwight Eisenhower put it, it's taking away from schools and hospitals and everything over here that could be done that would actually serve us and serve the community that are pretty desperately needed here. So, it's relevant. And it looks like my man in Orlando, even though I spoke to him recently, is not calling in. So it's late. It's 9:30 his time over there. He's in Florida, of course, and we're here. So what I'm going to do instead is, I think what I'll do is just sort of pass on to you what he told me, and that can kind of cover, I'll cover for his absence here, assuming I can find it, of course, on this computer, which is always a questionable. Let's see here. So, Food Not Bombs in Orlando has been repeatedly arrested for serving more than 26 people in Lake Eola Park, which is apparently, according to Ben, and I haven't looked it up myself, the sort of fancy signature park of Orlando, which is, some people may know, the site of Disney World. It's a big tourist destination. On Monday in Orlando, there was a city council meeting where 20 Food Not Bombs people, either servers or sympathizers, spoke out 5 minutes each. See, Ryan Coonerty wisely limits people to 2 minutes so they can't get much out before he can move on to the next order of business, and he limits the total time to 30 minutes. In Orlando, they talked for over an hour at 5 minutes each. So apparently Orlando has considerably more democracy and public access than Santa Cruz, but what else is new? You had thought that Santa Cruz was more liberal than Orlando because, after all, they're not really arresting people for serving food. Well, the reason they're not in Santa Cruz is because a lot of us stood up and got arrested 20 years ago and said, you arrest us, we're going to embarrass the hell out of you. And we did, and they arrested us, and so they stopped arresting us. In fact, they set up the free meal program in order to provide alternatives to the kind of Food Not Bombs type meals we were feeding at the town clock and elsewhere in the city. And that's, I'm not saying that isn't a positive thing for the city to do, although, of course, their motivation was to draw attention away from their treatment of the homeless. And so, in a way, it's not positive at all. It's a sort of a slimy attempt to evade the issues that we were raising. But it did provide food to people, and they did stop arresting people for serving, because they realized that, at least in Santa Cruz, there was enough of a constituency at that time to just keep feeding and keep taking arrests. And we did. I was arrested multiple times, never convicted of serving free food. They dropped the prosecutions by that time, but a number of people were. One woman, Sandra Loringer, served about a month in jail. I was later convicted of serving free food in San Francisco, where this was also another so-called liberal city, where it took over 1,000 arrests to eventually stop them from serving free food. Keith, as you may remember, Keith McHenry, the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, was, I believe he's had it on the air when I interviewed him last week. He said that the reason that they dropped the charges against the hundreds of people that they had arrested was because Food Not Bombs activists and sympathizers had begun videotaping the feedings and the busts, and the DA apparently realized he could not win a case before a jury if those videos were shown. In my case, the only case actually taken to trial of Food Not Bombs in 1994, there was no video. There was only testimony. And my main witness, Keith McHenry, who would testify that we weren't allowed permits and that we weren't violating an injunction, and that we, when we attempted to get permits on the 110 occasions, and Keith McHenry and other Food Not Bombs activists in San Francisco were quite militant about trying to use legal approaches to get the permits they required, they were ignored, dismissed. And when they finally got permits, the whole permit process was disestablished in order to delegitimize what was going on. Anyway, I did serve some time in jail, and I kind of was reading over my journal, which I wrote at that time, and I haven't really thoroughly reviewed it since then. I kind of get this stuff done, and it goes into the dusty archives, and then sometime in the future I pull out fragments of it. But I noticed that on the... what Food Not Bombs did when I was jailed for serving free food in San Francisco in 1996, 2 years later, after being convicted, of violating an injunction. That's what I was convicted of. The organization fed people on the steps of the jail every breakfast, every morning when I was in jail. The first day, Keith McHenry himself was arrested for doing that, and in the days that followed, they stopped arresting, and for the next several years, under Mayor Willie Brown, there were no further arrests of Food Not Bombs. Although, periodically, different mayors do and police officers do begin to arrest activists for doing this, there is, not on the basis of any documented health problems that have come up, though I imagine there have been some health problems, just as there have been health problems with any other group, though Food Not Bombs, I think, is less susceptible to that because they don't serve meat products, at least in San Francisco and Santa Cruz they didn't. And often, and generally speaking, that's one of the most Food Not Bombs, I think, are, although I don't have any stats, certainly Keith McHenry encourages them to be vegan, although everybody does their own thing in Food Not Bombs. There's no top-down orders from the chief and that sort of thing. Anyway, getting back to what's happening in Orlando, Florida, this Monday, and it's on Monday mornings and Wednesday nights that Orlando Food Not Bombs does its meals. On Monday, it's served food at City Hall, apparently taking up Mayor John, quote, Buddy Dyer's proposal that they serve food there and not be arrested because the mayor was concerned about Lake Eola, the sort of fancy park. He didn't want Food Not Bombs intruding into a fancy park, even though it's a public park, because the visible sight of poor people there was a tourist turnoff. Of course, that's not what the mayor said exactly, but that's kind of, I think, what the point was, according to Food Not Bombs activists. So, but they decided to take the mayor at his word. They went down, they served food Monday at the in front of the City Hall. They weren't arrested there, so the mayor apparently kept his word. They then went into the City Council chambers and spoke, as I mentioned, for over an hour, 5 minutes each, 20 of them. It sounds like that's for 20, that's 100 minutes. That's almost 2 hours. And I asked if there was any video of that, and he said, apparently there is video, but I don't know if it's available on a website. For some city councils, such as the Arcata City Council or the Eureka City Council, I believe, there is streaming video, and it's also archived video, and it's possible to actually view what people have said and done in those situations. In Santa Cruz, that's not the case, though you can buy, and now fairly cheaply, a DVD of the city council proceedings. So if you want to see what happened in the doggy debate of last Tuesday, when there was this non-homeless dogs allowed suspension of the doggy ban passed by the city council, 4-2, I believe it was, you can get a DVD of it, and I will, because I kind of keep tabs on these things, although it's been a while since I've reviewed any of these city council meetings. I'm going there less and less because what they've done is they've made it very difficult to speak unless you really want to risk incarceration, repression, and having to go through long court processes, which I'm still doing, to hold mayors accountable for my false arrest way back in 2002, where I was arrested for making a mock Nazi salute at city council after the mayor threatened several people inappropriately and repressively, and I think in violation of the Brown Act, not to mention the First Amendment of the Constitution, with incarceration if they, an exclusion from the council meeting if they didn't sit down and shut up, even though they hadn't said a word, really. And they had been waiting patiently for half an hour to speak. But anyway, at Orlando, who knows what they're doing down there, but according to Ben, they spoke at length at City Hall. And Keith McHenry, the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, who was jailed for 17 days and released finally several days ago, I guess about a week ago now, almost, not quite. And he had written a letter to the mayor of Orlando on June 13th, a month and a half ago, or actually, I guess about a month ago now, asking for a meeting. And the mayor, Mayor Dyer, said he hadn't received the letter. So the Food Not Bombs activists in Orlando brought it to the city council meeting on Monday. And the mayor then said he was willing to meet with them to talk about things. And this seemed to be encouraging to Ben Markison, the fellow I spoke to. And so the mayor said they can share at food at any time they wanted at City Hall, so long as they don't go back to Lake Eola Park. Stay at the back of the bus, and you'll be okay, is sort of the way I interpret it. And they may accept this, they said, with some stipulations, which I would find unfortunate from my distant position, but then I'm not going there every Monday and Wednesday and in solidarity with them and offering to get arrested. Though I was at City Hall in Santa Cruz on June 30th, sleeping in my vehicle outside City Hall, which would have made me subject to a citation if the officers had given citations to me or any of the other six protesters who slept there. And that was against the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban and against the laws that criminalize the homeless and the police practices that are doing that, involving the sitting ban, the panhandling ban, the street performing ban. And when I use the word ban, I'm speaking about severe restrictions. It's not entirely banned. It's just severely restricted and subject to all kinds of selective enforcement. So you never know when the cops are going to stop you, hassle you, harass you. You'd better be prepared to do exactly what the cops say, regardless of what the law says, because you're not going to get justice in the courts under the law. And I'm going to be challenging that, I'm pretty sure, ineffectively, but we'll see when I go to an appeal case myself, and that's going to be next Thursday. It's going to be the 21st of July. I think that's Thursday. Let's see, today is the 14th, so it'll be the Thursday, the 21st, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Department 3. I'll be appearing before three judges, along with Robert Blindbear Facer, who's also a performer, and he's a homeless guy, who is being represented by attorney, activist, and jailbird Ed Fry. He'll be arguing that case before the three-judge panel, I believe headed by Judge Paul Maraganda, of whom I have a very low opinion. Sorry about that, Paul, but that's just how it is. That issue had to do, as regular listeners know, the right to sing songs about political events that, well, the political mob that criminalizes homeless people in Santa Cruz. Although I didn't even name any names, I don't think. The name Coonerty, our mayor, was not mentioned. The name Don Lane, our vice mayor, was not mentioned. No, I just talked about the actual ordinances and practices in that song, which you've heard me sing before, you know, when you're alone and rents are making you homeless, you can always go downtown. When you get laid off, all the cops and their friends will move you to and fro downtown. Try and find musicians who can tolerate the city. Linger on the sidewalk and the police will say no sitting. How can you win? The crowds are much wider there. They just step over your troubles, walk past all your cares when you're downtown. And that's, I think we sung 8 or 9 verses of that at one point in an hour and a half protest in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, which is Mayor Coonerty's business, in spite of all his disclaimers. It's his family's business, around his criminalization of the homeless and increasing repression against poor people downtown, not to mention giveaways to developers and businesses. We won't get into that at the moment, but, boy, I hope I educate myself better on that one, because it's kind of the other side of the equation. Anyway, I'm going to court to challenge my conviction for so-called unreasonably disturbing noise for singing that song. And you might say, well, maybe you were just a bad singer. Well, no, there was a day sleeper named Sean Riley, who was above the bookshop Santa Cruz and the St. George Hotel apartments there. And without warning us, without telling us that he was having any problems down there, he called the police, who told us that, you know, they'd received a complaint. And we asked the Officer Schoenfeld, what's the deal? You know, how loudly can we sing? We're in the middle of the day. This is between 1:30 and 3 in the... It was 3 in the afternoon when she contacted us. And, you know, I mean, there's a normal volume of noise downtown. And she said, that's not my business. I'll just be citing you because the citizen wants me to cite you. You might say, well, you know, that's... She's just doing her job. Well, she didn't convey to that citizen our message, which was, we're willing to sing more quietly if you give us a level of singing where we can legally sing and still be exercising our First Amendment rights. She wouldn't do that. Perhaps she felt she couldn't. But obviously there's a defect there somewhere, and to hold us accountable for that is simply to empower the police and private citizens to shut down songs and music that they don't want to hear on Pacific Avenue, regardless of how loud it is. We presented testimony at a trial, numerous people, it was a normal volume, wasn't loud, it wasn't prolonged, it didn't cause physical pain in the ears, and that meant nothing to Commissioner Baskett. We weren't allowed to go before a jury because this was an infraction case. We were found guilty after what was, as far as I know, the longest infraction trial I have ever attended or heard about in Santa Cruz. It lasted for, I think, 14 hours of testimony, and we are now appealing Commissioner Baskett's decision, which was something to the effect that we were in a conspiracy to disrupt the bookshop Santa Cruz, and it was a series of accusations against us that really came way out of the blue from her. We hadn't expected, and that had very little to do with the actual criteria being used in this ordinance. Anyway, this will be happening, for those of you who are interested in checking it out, on Thursday, a week from today, 4 o'clock in Department 3, and I'll be talking about it a little bit more on Sunday, maybe, I don't know, playing a highlight or two, maybe we'll have a round or two of downtown, because it has been repressive. They have been effective in cutting back at least singing protests on Pacific Avenue from Huff and from other activists that I know. Although it's also true that sort of just wild and crazy singing, even late at night, sometimes way into the wee hours of the night, happens on Pacific Avenue without the police doing anything, which may tend to show that they want to go after activists, and they don't really care if it's people that are not trying to make a political point. And although, in all fairness to the officers involved, this was done on a citizen complaint, and that's kind of the new mantra being used by the police department, whether it's they're showing a sleeping ban citation or other citations. We're doing this because the citizens have complained. We have a citizen complaint. And, of course, that's not really relevant. The issue is whether some people are really breaking the law and whether the law is constitutional, fair, just, or right. And these, of course, the issues that we the citizenry, we, the community, have to be concerned about, because the authorities are definitely not. Just as the national authorities couldn't care less except it's bad publicity, how many civilians get mowed down in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Egypt. They don't care. And they don't really care how many homeless people are arrested here in Santa Cruz or harassed on the streets. It's up to the community to awaken itself to what's going on, and that's what shows like this try to do. That was a very long excursion away from the Orlando, Florida update. But I kind of really told you what I think Ben Markison was going to pass on to me, and so maybe it's okay that he didn't call in. He probably had other things he needed to do, because there are about 30 people facing misdemeanor trials for serving free food. The trials will probably go away if they agree to this deal with the mayor and the city council there, that they will only serve at City Hall and they won't serve at Lake Eola Park, which sounds to me like kind of a bad capitulation. But again, you know, it's hard to say because I'm not there on the scene. Let's take a musical break, and I'll be back, and hopefully you'll be back. I want to remind you that you can call in to discuss these issues, 831-427-3772. Free Radio Santa Cruz is what you're listening to, 427-3772. Give me a call.
As I looked out my window at the clear blue sky, at the planes that flew so low, at the smoke that rose so high, the air filled up with dust that blackened out the sun, and the politicians went on about the new day that had begun. And when I looked at my calendar, I knew it would be so. It was on this day in Santiago. Less than 30 years had passed, and how clearly I remember what the city had been like before that day in September. There were doctors on the sidewalks helping those in need, students in the barrios teaching children how to read. There were milk trucks in the shanties driving to and fro on this day in Santiago. I could tell you about the rallies, the whole city in the street. The president was speaking and we all were on our feet. Allende was the future, destitution was the past. The city was in motion and things were changing fast. Just how fast they were changing, only Kissinger could know. On this day in Santiago, Anaconda Copper and Nixon got their dream. A country torn apart, ruptured at the seam. A fascist coup was what they wanted, and that's just what they'd get when they sent down from Fort Benning General Pinochet. Lady Liberty hung her head down low on this day in Santiago. They dropped bombs on La Moneda with jet planes from D.C. They killed 5,000 people in our city by the sea. A reign of terror started when they cut off Victor's hands. The rivers clogged with bodies and our blood drenched the sands. And I remember wondering which way future winds might blow on this day in Santiago.
And that was another one by Rovix, the overthrow of Salvador Allende in 1973. And here's some of the notes. Allende was a doctor and a socialist who was elected to the Chilean presidency in 1970 on a platform that included the nationalization of the copper mines in order to use Chile's resources to feed Chile's people. Anaconda Copper and the Nixon administration, among other representatives of the corporate elite, didn't like this, and they set about to destabilize Allende's government and Chile's economy. On September 11, 1973, a far-right junta within the Chilean military led a coup involving the bombing of the presidential palace, La Moneda, and the death of Allende. Many thousands more would soon be tortured and killed over the course of a long and vicious dictatorship in Chile. Before and since the coup, the CIA and the now renamed School of the Americas have played an active role in training and funding the torturers. That's a U.S. torture school. Supporters of radical free market ideology such as Milton Friedman and his followers like to say that under the dictatorship, Chile's economy thrived, but nothing could be further from the truth. Things may have looked fine if you didn't leave the downtown core of Santiago, but the rest of the country was suffering, and the economic crisis of the late 1980s was only eased when the junta stopped following Friedman's free market recipe. It is often claimed that those who support the mainstream historical narrative of the high school textbooks, that the United States actively supports democracies and opposes dictatorships around the world. If you repeat something up often enough, people will start believing it. But no matter how many times it's said, in however many ways, it's still not true. The hard truth is that the U.S. has for centuries been actively undermining democracies and supporting dictatorships around the world while claiming to do exactly the opposite. Allende was only another in a list that began long before 1973, including names like Arbenz and Mossadegh. Arbenz was a Guatemalan president. Mossadegh was an Iranian socialist, or I don't think he was even a socialist, but he wanted to nationalize the oil in Iran way back in the early 50s. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And I'm Robert Norris, and who knows who you are, but you know who you are. So let's roll into some street interviews now, and that way you'll get to hear somebody else along with me. Stay tuned.
So let's have a positive report here on three police officers who are at the outside the Taqueria Vallarta working on a stolen bike report, Sergeant Bush. Is that correct?
Somebody got their bike stolen a few minutes ago. It matches that one right there, so we're going to have the victim come by in a little bit and see if that is their stolen bike so we can get it back to them.
I appreciate that. And Officer Winston was courteous enough to call me across the street to correct the misimpression that I had, and which I expressed loudly, that the police may be wasting public funds. I don't think going after stolen bicycles is a waste of public funds, and I thank you for correcting my misimpression, Officer Winston.
You're welcome.
All right.
Now, having said that, and indeed I wanted to be fair to our police officers, I should say the police officers that are paid for with our tax dollars, and tens of dollars, and hundreds of dollars, and thousands of dollars, and tens of thousands of dollars, that Officer Winston is still accused of seriously attacking physically someone in the last 2 months downtown at the corner of Soquel and Pacific, in a widely witnessed incident. The individual who was attacked has not been seen in the last month or so. A little bit concerned about him, but at one point I did a kind of a monologue of some of the recorded claims and criticisms of Officer Winston reports. Ticketing, harassment, and on some occasions violence by that police officer. And this this really concerns me because I think Officer Winston and I probably don't like each other much, although I don't really dislike him personally. I mean, you know, he's another person on Pacific Avenue, and sometimes, you know, he calls me properly to account, as he did in this case when I saw, two squad cars and three cops and two security guards hanging out in front of Taqueria Vallarta. And I thought, oh, what's going on here? Are your taxpayer dollars at work? And he said, well, we're investigating a stolen bicycle. Why that wouldn't require three police officers and two security guards, I don't know. But, you know, that still, it's a legitimate police function, or it's a legitimate community function, which, in this case, police officers seem to have taken on. And that's, I'm glad if anybody takes on trying to retrieve a stolen bicycle, because I wouldn't like to have my bicycle stolen if I had one, and like that. But on the other hand, there is so much day-to-day harassment of poor and homeless people downtown, enforcement of abusive laws, and then physical abuse when the authority of these officers is challenged, whether it's Officer Azua physically attacking Cynthia Kennedy. And I haven't heard anything from her in a year. That happened about a year ago now, a year ago, April. And it happened around the same place, about a block from New Leaf. A lot of this stuff happens. Let me put it this way. My reports from her were that it happened a block away from New Leaf. My reports about Winston's assault on a fellow named Chad, Mr. Chad, were by three different people. And they had a lot more credibility, as well as the victim himself. And I have to admit, I have not made a formal police complaint, which usually is sort of pointless, except that it does put things on the police officer's record for 5 years, that a complaint was made, and of course it was immediately thrown in the trash can, but still has to sit there for 5 years, saying not sustained, unjustified, so forth, exonerated. But there is a new website, a CopWatch website. I think it's called Bad Cop. And it's one which you can find online. Let me see if I can give the exact address. I believe it's probably been mentioned by other broadcasters. I can't imagine that it hasn't. But let's see if I can bring it up here. Santa Cruz Bad Cop. Bad Cop. Let's see here. Bad Cop Santa Cruz focuses on police accountability, know your rights, education, and the dissemination of effective tactics to utilize while documenting police in Santa Cruz. You can go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz or Santa Cruz Indie Media to find that out or to get more information on this. Bad Cop Santa Cruz, it's there, along with a photo of a sergeant with a riot gun approaching the farmers market to disperse drum circle militants who were upset at Sergeant Harm's expedition to track down the person who snipped the plastic to eliminate the little fence around the tree that was being used regularly to inhibit and discourage people from public assembly there. The website is Bad Cops, Cops SC. Bad Cop Santa Cruz, in other words, badcopsc.blogspot.com. And it's a new website where people are encouraged to post, report bad cops. Here you can report police abuse, brutality, perjury, incompetence, malfeasance, or stupidity local to the Santa Cruz area. You'll need a few things. You need the cop name or badge number, details about the incident, and a narrative of what happened. You can also, if you got a photo or video or a photo of the incident or scene, you can decide whether you want to make your report anonymously or use your name or offer contact information, and leaving contact info may make it easier for someone else who may be fighting police in civil or criminal court. And there's, of course, reports, and there's some recent reports. Sergeant Christian Lamas, who beat up Donna Dice. There was the brutal attack by Officer Eveleth and other police officers at the UCSC Tent City gathering in 2005. There were the violent arrests at the farmers market mentioned before by Sergeant Harms and other officers, leading to a near riot. Those actually aren't too recent, but there are apparently a growing number of reports on this site, and I'm pleased to see that because I think it's really important that people speak up about what they have seen, what they've experienced, and what they want to see changed. And Bad Cop Santa Cruz is a website you should check out. And, of course, my radio show has for a decade and a half been reporting verbally on police incidents, according to the reports I get from the street as well as when I'm actually viewing them, which, you know, has limited value, but it does have some value because I try to be accurate. I try to be fair. I definitely tend to have a bias. There's no question about it. But I also try, you know, to be really clear about what the reports of the different folks are. I think we have a system that's prejudiced in favor of the rich. It's prejudiced in favor of established businesses and residents and developers. And I think that the police force essentially is their hired guns. And there are instances where this is not true. And I have to take my hat off in a combination of amazement and appreciation when those incidents come up, such as when Mayor Mike Rotkin tried to have me arrested at an ACLU meeting in 2007 because I had a sign that said end the sleeping ban ACLU because they hadn't been even discussing it, although ACLUs in other cities had actually taken the case to court, but not in Santa Cruz, because in Santa Cruz ACLU seems to be deeply entangled with the political establishment here, which, of course, wants to keep laws in place that criminalize homeless people, or rather is afraid to even touch them because of the power of the police lobby. It's not entirely clear. You know, different council members have different motives, but they all pretty much make a nasty stew that produces the same objective, which is turning poor people into criminals for doing what they need to do, whether it's sleeping or resting or sitting with their property or having a pet with them. All these things become crimes unless, you know, you behave in an follow whatever instructions the police officer gives you at the moment, however absurd, however illegal, however abusively said. That, unfortunately, to me, is the mark of the police state, and that is something that we have to fight, and that's something that Bad Cop Santa Cruz, I think, is fighting, and I'm glad that they are. Back to the other voices that I promised. I promised other voices. Now, I want to remind you, you can have your own voice on Free Radio Santa Cruz. All you have to do is call in, 427-3772, 427-3772. That's the number to call. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it now. Yes, you can. Go to the phone. Make a call. Well, if you have something you want to say on the air, that you certainly have that option. Let's see what else we've got here.
And it's a few moments after my discussion at the corner of Cathcart and Carden Pacific with Officers Winston Warren, Sergeant Bush, and two other, well, there was a host and a private security guard there initially when I walked across the street. What I didn't say at the time, and I wished I had as I walked away, l'esprit de l'escalier, the spirit of the back stairs, what you wished you'd said as you walk up the back stairs later, is to say to Sergeant Bush, Officer Winston, did you talk with Sergeant Bush about your assault on Curtis Chad, where you struck him three times at least with a baton, and is that going to be your normal practice with other people in the future? Because
again, my claim that this happened comes not from my visually seeing it, but from hearing it from three different people who I interviewed independently of each other.
That was what several witnesses claimed, and concerns me. But I didn't do that, and hopefully I will the next time the occasion arises. My apologies to my radio audience. And to Sergeant Bush, Officer Warren, and Officer Winston, who I think I got caught up again in the flurry of the uniforms. As I walked across the street, they first accused me of jaywalking, and I said, launched into a defense instead of just sort of smiling, saying, what's happening, officers? The idea that you have to respond to the police is something that people should be aware of is not the case. It's completely up to you what you do. Of course, I did respond to Officer Winston's, come across the street and we'll talk about it. And I did. We're talking with Ed Davidson outside City Council meeting after the Tuesday City Council 5 o'clock ghetto session where the new oral communication has been marginalized and people are essentially separated from the rest of the business of City Council. Ed,
this is about a month or more ago. at a council meeting where I believe I spoke during this ghetto period where you're separated from all the rest of the people who come to city council meetings. The city council itself comes in for a special, very quick, we'll hear you talk for your 2 minutes and then we're leaving session, and that is that. There's no interaction usually between the city council and the community. The rest of the community doesn't get to hear you, although it is televised, so in theory they can hear you. I mean, if they're watching television, they have cable access, or if they buy a DVD afterward. But the actual ongoing process of a city council meeting where oral communications, and almost every other city council I've ever heard of, and certainly in Santa Cruz city councils traditionally, oral communications happens at the beginning of a city council meeting where people get a chance to talk, and therefore the people who are there for the whole council meeting will hear you, whether they want to or not, because it's a part of the public dialogue. Well, Mayor Coonerty has made it so this is not the case, and I think it's a deliberate attempt to discourage people from talking at this, at the oral communications. And also, it's a deliberate attempt to discourage those activists who do talk at oral communications from staying for city council meetings and talking on other items, because these two segments of the meeting are significantly separated. You have to kind of go away and come back after waiting a period of time instead of having one flow into the other, as has traditionally been the case. Also, the most well-attended oral communications period, the 7 o'clock oral communications traditionally in Santa Cruz, no longer exists. As often, the 7 o'clock meetings no longer exist, but they've instead been put into the afternoon. There is instead this minor period at 5 o'clock where you can talk. Anyway, Ed Davidson is a frequent speaker at the oral communications and on some subjects. He's very interested in redevelopment and housing, and he had some strong opinions which he wanted to discuss, and so we talked outside.
Myself raised some issues which are kind of technical, and I don't want you to go into those so much as the background of the proposed hotel development on Broadway.
Well, my big objection to the hotel is that it's a commercial use in a residential zone.
Right, but who's behind it? What you say the Patels, who run the Santa Cruz Motel, but formerly the Motel 6, and another motel are behind it?
Right, the Torchlight Motel. And they've been involved with other hotels in Santa Cruz.
And you say in the past they failed to pay the transient occupancy tax?
Right. They collected for the city, but they haven't produced it.
And that's the tax that essentially sustains social services in the city?
Well, it's for whatever, you know, it's just revenue for the city, which we need. Uh-huh. And because they were being taken to court over their arrears in making the payments,
right,
they filed bankruptcy on these two motels,
and now they want to put up another motel half a block away.
Right.
And for those who don't know, again, this will be at the corner, near the corner of Broadway and Ocean Streets. So we're talking right across from the 7-Eleven, a bit towards, on the other side of the street, a bit towards the river.
Right. A four-story hotel? Motel?
Four stories, two levels of underground parking, next to residential on both sides on Broadway.
And how do locals feel about that?
The neighbors were pretty unhappy about it. There were a few who, Chamber of Commerce came in and supported it and so on. They were looking at the transit occupancy tax revenue. That was their big motivation.
How much of it gets to the Chamber of Commerce?
Well, I think they were just supporting the idea of a hotel with, money to...
I mean, didn't Chamber of Commerce oppose an increase in the transient occupancy tax some years back?
Well, I don't remember that, but they may have, and it wasn't raised, as I recall.
Because of opposition from businesses.
Right. There was a question of whether, there's a law of diminishing returns when you raise the tax too high.
Do we know anything about what the residential vacancies are in hotels and motels this year and last year compared with, say, prior years?
I don't have numbers like that.
That would be relevant to this kind of discussion. I mean, it would be my
I wouldn't wonder if there is, in fact, a serious drop in such use of motels and motels because of the depression that we're in the middle of, and it seems to be getting worse with businesses shutting down all over the county.
Well, they're... I'm sure the hotels have had harder times in the last couple of years as people cut back on their discretionary spending. But
you do think so, because I know that certainly residential property hasn't even been this bad during the Depression, as I understand it, in terms of the drop there.
Well, Las Vegas has shown a big drop-off in gambling receipts in the last couple of years.
We don't know what the situation is. See, those are the stats I always ask for. For example, when the police, you know, suddenly want to increase and make a triple fine zone, as they did apparently, I guess, today, although I assume they passed.
Fourth of July weekend.
Not only do we have it for a day, now we have it for 3 days,
right.
Which is, you know, it sounds like an attempt to create speed traps, so to speak, of a different kind throughout Santa Cruz, where as a revenue-raising device against primarily people who are probably, I guess it's tourists, so maybe you could say, well, if you can nab the tourists, it'll let the rest of us off. Were you here when they passed that proposal?
I think it was on consent, and I didn't raise an objection, but I did think that... from the 2nd to the 5th was a little bit excessive.
Well, it's unusual. It's usually like one day that they do it,
and
at Halloween and at New Year's.
We have the Halloween situation, which there have been problems with drinking and so on. And, you know, but I mean, how many,
those kind of problems.
Yeah, but how many people go drinking on the 4th of July? I mean, it doesn't seem to... be the kind of magnet for...
I don't think there was a huge problem last year, as I remember from the... Of course, the Sentinel is always a disreputable source, but... So, I question about... Were you at the entire city council meeting this afternoon or not?
No.
Because I was wondering if... Because we had our mayor... We had acting mayor Don Lane, who was the vice mayor, apparently covering for Ryan Coonerty, who's out of the town. Do you know if he, if people, when requested that consent agenda items be pulled, actually did so?
I was about the only person who did want to speak to a consent agenda item, and I wanted to support the what was on there, and I was here just to counteract anyone who might have...
So you didn't ask for that the item be pulled off for a separate vote?
I didn't. It let me have my couple of minutes to just make my point.
Well, they do give you 2 minutes to talk on, I guess, what, 30 items on the consent agenda as a total.
Right. And
again, for those who don't know, and I don't include any of my regular listeners in this since I always bring it up, Santa Cruz used to have a situation whereby the consent agenda, which has... anywhere from 6 or 7 to 30 items on it, and is usually voted on in one vote because it's supposed to be sort of, you know, pro forma. Everybody agrees to this. We don't have to go through each of these items individually. But if any member of the public wants to talk about any one of those items at all, she or he can pull it off the agenda, or a council member can, and talk about it for a brief period of time. And I used to do that with a couple of items each session, a couple of items. Although the city council will tell you I was... tremendously abusive, that's simply not true. It was a couple of items each session. And I spoke pertinently on the subjects involved. Now you can't do that anymore. The disunited community of Santa Cruz is tolerating Ryan Coonerty's policy of essentially saying, in order to talk on an individual consent agenda item, which makes up more than half the agenda usually, you have to get the permission of a council member. Which, you know, it's like you have to go to the king and his council to get an agreement to talk. Now, it is true that there is, as I said, a 2-minute period where you can hurriedly talk about any of the items on the consent agenda. If you can cram all that discussion, which does include up to 30 items, into 2 minutes. So you have to really be kind of like Woody Woodpecker in order to really talk really fast, or you have to have some sort of be in the good graces of a council member or somehow persuade them in that 2-minute period to allow you to talk on those items. I think this violates the Brown Act, but there are many who disagree with me, or some who disagree with me. But I certainly know it is not the typical process for city councils in California, and it certainly wasn't the process in Santa Cruz. So I just thought I would interrupt with that usual reminder to people who hadn't heard about this or had forgotten that we are in a situation where our public, not only are our public spaces being shrunk, where you're not allowed to be on the levee after dark, you're not allowed to be at City Hall with a sign after dark, you're not allowed to sleep on any public property anywhere, even if there's no shelter space after 11 o'clock at night. You're not allowed to sit down within 14 feet of a building in any downtown or business district or beach district. You're not allowed to ask for a dime after dark. I mean, I go on. You're not allowed to be in a parking lot unless you are parking a vehicle or walking directly through. A whole series of restrictions that give a special sharp edge to the police state in Santa Cruz, because they give the police the pretext to stop you, interrogate you, warrant check you, search you, and so forth, and cite you if they want, even arrest you if they want.
Yeah.
There were other things that I might have questioned about redevelopment, administrative overhead costs that are usually excessive to what they're actually required to do, but that's...
Now, Ed, this is a kind of a question that's sort of a historical one, but I don't know that we've talked about it recently. Were you a witness when I was arrested in 2002 at City Council for raising my arm briefly in a mock Nazi salute after the chair shut down Susan Zeman and also shut down Michael Tomasi from speaking? That was when Mayor Christopher Crone was mayor.
I was there that night.
And, I hadn't had a complete recollection of it, but I was told again by activist Becky Johnson, who reviewed the tapes and apparently was also the videographer who actually got this whole thing on video, that Crone had essentially promised everyone time to speak at this council meeting. But for the first time, he'd cut everybody back to 2 minutes, something not normally done at City Council. Usually, there's a long line. They expand oral communications, or had at that time, prior to 2002. That was our recollection. Mine's a little kind of hazy right now.
Mine too, about that specific.
Right, right.
But as I recall, that the person who was shut off was in a wheelchair?
Well, what I remember, and I don't really remember it, I remember it mainly from the videotapes. I don't have really an independent recollection of it right now. But as I recall from viewing those tapes, three of us have been asked, two of us, myself and Michael Tomasi, we have been asked to go to the back of the line because we'd spoken the week, 2 weeks before the prior council meeting, which is a procedure used but is considered unconstitutional by the First Amendment Coalition because it penalizes activists like yourself who do speak regularly at City Council, and there should be a first-come, first-serve procedure. I think that's what they have at the Board of Supervisors, for example, and other places as well. But be that as it may, apparently Coonerty Crone, who was then mayor, counted up all the hands and said, okay, all these people can speak. And then, when having waited, Tomasi came up to the mic, he was told he could not. This upset him, and he got angry, and Crone told him to leave the room, and he growled and said, I'll see you on the street, Butchie Baker, who is the sergeant at arms. And then Susan Zeman came up to the mic and said, did you see that? Did you see what just happened, that this man just been told he couldn't speak? And she, too, was directed to sit down or she would be arrested or removed from the chambers. I don't think the word arrest was used. So as she came toward me, I kind of smiled at her and went like this. The council, they turned to talk to her, at which point Fitz...
And I made what was a mock Nazi salute. And this is an important thing for me, probably not so important for listeners, because there is a trial that is likely coming up around this issue. Not my trial. I was never even charged by the district attorney. I was arrested and held in jail falsely, but never charged in a formal court proceeding, because I didn't disrupt the council meeting. The council disrupted its own meeting in order to get me to leave and to throw the blame and the guilt on me, when in fact it was their responsibility. What they were doing was they were cutting off the First Amendment and violating the Brown Act in order to exert authority and essentially show their own power to the community. And it's important to me because this is coming up probably in a trial, I would guess, in the late fall or the early spring of next year, assuming that the case doesn't go to the Supreme Court, which it may, because the city wants to spend a lot of money to get it there because it wants to preserve the city council's power to repress. Even if there's no real disruption, they want the power to tell people to leave that they don't like the expression of. and then can call that a disruption if they want. And that is what they do. And when I have brought things up in different ways, whether I one time I brought in a gold painted commode, a kind of a one of those things that you use for people who are bedridden, and presented the Golden Potty Award to then Mayor Catherine Byers for essentially cutting short bathrooms in Santa Cruz, not establishing the bathroom facilities that she needed. I was threatened with arrest for that. I've been threatened with arrest for all kinds of things at City Council that don't really involve any kind of disruption. They simply involve city officials being embarrassed by the sight of that, probably because of the content of the claims I'm making. And that, of course, is... Well, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, it's important for the community to be aware of these things. And on a broader basis, it's important for these things not to be suppressed generally because other people who have may have views extremely different from mine will also are also subject to the same kind of repression. Or they become afraid they are, which is even worse, and they don't even step up to try, as I have done over the years.
Flora stopped the meeting, even though he was not the mayor, and Christopher Cronin continued with it, and then we went through the whole process of an arrest, my removal for the mock Nazi salute. Do you remember any of that?
That part of it I remember. Mm-hmm. It was absurd to me because you hadn't disrupted the meeting, and Crone, sitting as mayor or chair, he never noticed anything wrong. He never saw a disruption,
right.
And he was prepared to continue doing what he was doing until he was interrupted, or disrupted, if you will, by the
council member
Fitzmaurice, yeah, and that.
Where were you sitting in the room when this happened? Do you remember?
I was, as I recall, I was about the middle row, and about toward the right side.
Uh-huh. You remember what issues you were there for that night? Long time ago. Yeah. Well, have things improved or deteriorated since 2002 in terms of city council procedure, in your opinion?
I think they're more stringent and less inviting of the public to interact with the council. I think that's a deliberate, as far as I'm concerned, deliberate intention to cut off the necessary and reasonable communications between the citizens and the council members. And that is bad. That is discouraging, especially on the illegal, if you will, consent agenda request for time to address an issue on consent agenda. You're not allowed to address it unless a council member pulls it from the consent agenda. And
which puts them in the cat seat.
Well, it's the point is that the items, whether on consent or not, are noticed public hearings at which a person is allowed to speak. The interference between the consent agenda items and the council permission to speak to it is.
Violates the Brown Act?
Violates the Brown Act, absolutely.
Although I've talked to, again, First Amendment Coalition, who I don't necessarily regard as the expert in all things, and in this case I didn't like what they told me, which was that the two-minute period they provide for people to speak on any and all of the consent agenda items as a block satisfies the Brown Act requirement. What's your reaction to that?
It does not satisfy it, because if you ever pick up an agenda, you will see that there is an admonition there that in order to bring a lawsuit against the city, you must have spoken to the issue at the hearing. And if you're not allowed to speak to the issue at the hearing, you're not allowed to sue.
If they don't hold the hearing, you don't have to speak to the issue. You don't get a chance to speak to the issue.
No, but the thing is that it that's the Brown Act and the Code of Civil Procedure requires that If you're going to sue, you have to raise the issues. You can only sue on the issues that you raised in your testimony.
But they would claim at the public hearing, and essentially was the two-minute period when all 30 or odd items you had a chance to speak at, I don't know, Woody Woodpecker speed and go through all the items you needed to go through. And you're saying that not only is that perhaps not possible, but it also doesn't really meet the requirements of speaking at the public hearing so that you can then later raise the issue in a lawsuit.
That's exactly the point.
We've been talking with Ed Davidson. Ed, any final remarks?
Well, we're still waiting for La Bahia to go to the Coastal Commission, and it's got some problems, lots of real problems, and despite the PR blitz, especially in the good times, they gave them a PR piece that belonged to the...
like a paid commercial?
Yeah. Certainly was, and it was very one-sided and missed all the coastal issues involved. Some other time we'll get into that when it comes up. But
thank you, Ed. You've been going to City Council since?
71.
Longer than me. Thanks, Ed. We're here at Mythic Games right across from the footbridge.
And actually... That was an account of somebody who reportedly actually dived off or jumped off. He didn't do it head first. The San Lorenzo Bridge. I didn't see it, but somebody else did and was really it was agitated and amazed by it. And I actually did a brief interview with that person. And then we actually saw the person later who apparently jumped off. His clothes were wet, reportedly. But he wasn't injured, and so that's amazing that somebody can actually jump off feet first off the San Lorenzo footbridge. I'm still wondering about that one. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, or Freak Radio, and the phone number here, for those of you who have phones and feel so inclined, is 831-427-3772, 427-3772. Let's hear some more from Morovix, and then you'll hear some more from me. I'm Robert Norris.
Grew up on a farm in a troubled Irish land, under foreign rule and the British Crown's command. His father fought for Ireland 50 years before, but the Free State cut their losses and the English won the war. When internment without trial was the order of the day, when his brother was arrested and his friends were blown away, when he was beaten near to death, he decided, come what may, he'd throw his lot in with the provost and he joined the IRA. In the occupied six counties, perhaps it never will be known, all the foreign soldiers in Armagh and Tyrone, who decided to head back across the Irish Sea so they wouldn't have to meet the man from south of Derry. He never wavered in his battle for Irish liberty, and the Crown would soon regret the day they made him enemy. The Brits called it bandit country, and it filled them all with fright. In the border lands, he who walked the hills at night. Up the provost, that's what he said. Three little words that filled the British Crown with dread. With a rifle on his shoulder, a timer and a fuse, long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Once he was surrounded by the SAS, how he might escape was anybody's guess. In his boots and camouflage, he didn't miss a beat. He walked right past the soldiers and out into the street. Once he came upon the checkpoint, the soldier didn't want to die. He recognized our Francis and the soldier waved him by. He didn't want to find out if he could take what he could give. He knew there'd be a shootout and the soldier chose to live. Up the provost, that's what he said. And from this farmer's son, better men had fled. With a rifle on his shoulder, a timer and a fuse, long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. The North's most wanted man, with his photo everywhere. But he eluded capture with his wit and dyed blonde hair. For 6 years he was active, three times as long as most. He became a legend, north to south and coast to coast. He came upon two soldiers out one night on patrol. They shot him in the firefight, and the bullets took their toll. He crawled off into the bushes, but they found him the next day. Grabbed him by his arms and they carried him away. Up the provost, that's what he said. With a shattered bone and a body full of lead. With a rifle on his shoulder, a timer and a fuse. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. They beat him and they tortured him and they gave him 80 years. When they brought him to the H blocks, he was greeted there with cheers. He went right onto the blanket, and when the hunger strike began, he was the first to volunteer along with Bobby Sands. He was an Irish soldier and that's how he did his time. He knew he was no criminal, occupation was the crime. Bobby Sands had passed beyond us where Francis soon would be. And although he couldn't stand and he could barely see. Up the provost, that's what he said. As they carried him to hospital to lay in his deathbed. With a rifle on his shoulder, a timer and a fuse. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Up the provost, that's what he said. And the next day there'd be another standing in his stead. With a rifle on his shoulder, a timer and a fuse. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes. Long may we remember Commandante Francis Hughes.
Up the Provost, the song for Francis Hughes, another one from Troubadour by David Rovix. Some of his notes: in the early 20th century, most of Ireland won its freedom from half a millennium of British rule. Six of Ireland's 32 counties remained within the United Kingdom, Britain, however, and within the occupied six counties, there has been conflict in one form or another around questions of sovereignty ever since. The simmering conflict took a decidedly violent turn in the decades following Bloody Sunday, when British troops in Derry hunted down and shot 13 supporters of the Irish civil rights movement. British efforts to crush the resistance throughout the draconian measures, such as an internment without trial, only fueled more anger. Francis Hughes is one of the 10 men who died on hunger strike in prison in 1981 in Northern Ireland. He was already a legend before he joined the hunger strike for being an extremely daring and effective guerrilla fighter, as well as for being a man of few words. Francis Hughes. So, about 20 minutes left here in the program. And there was a city council meeting on Tuesday that I didn't get to and actually only read about. But what I'm going to try to do is get the update from somebody who was there, the irrepressible Stephen Plaich. And I think we may be able to find him, or maybe not. Let's see if we can actually get through to that guy.
We'll give him a ring-a-ding-ding and see if he's available. Stephen Plaich.
That's me.
You're on Free Radio, so watch what you say.
My very good friends from Free Radio. All my good friends.
Yes. Now, Stephen, shall I call you Stephen or shall I call you Steve?
You may call me Steve.
So, Steve, I know that did you actually get to the evening session of City Council on Tuesday?
I did.
And did you hear the barks, growls, and hiccups of the doggy debate?
I did. Many woofers and walkers were there, so it was quite the event.
Were any doggies in the audience?
No, I didn't. Oh, you know what? I didn't see any dogs. I don't think anybody brought
so their
dogs.
So the canines, as usual, were excluded from any participation.
Well, but they were being well represented by their owners.
I see. So you say. I mean,
I'm not certain that legally dogs can represent themselves. No,
probably not. Captive pets.
I think it's like lawyers in small claims court. I think
Speciesism Incorporated, I must
there
call
you
it.
Go. Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't. I've read the article. It was a fairly long article by, I guess, the earlier article describing what was coming up at City Council by J.M. Brown was followed by a report about the City Council meeting. You and I talked about it yesterday at the end of the Huff meeting, and you had some observations about it. I guess there was there was one member of the City Council missing, David Terezas, who's usually
he
with
was,
the,
yeah.
the Coonerty cabal.
Mm-hmm.
And instead you had six people there, and there was an issue about panhandlers and their dogs. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, there's a provision in the panhandling law that it's illegal to panhandle with an animal. And Don Lane offered an amendment to the repeal of the dog ordinance, the trial repeal of the dog ordinance, that would have exempted panhandlers with dogs from that ordinance because they felt like it unnecessarily punished people who had dogs. The panhandling is legal, but with dogs it's illegal, and it seemed to be a bit unfair to him, so he offered an amendment to the proposed ordinance, the proposed pilot ordinance, and there was a vote, and it was 3-3, and so it was voted down because he needed a majority. But he made the effort, you know, trying to speak on behalf of people who are, you know, just trying to, you know, make a few bucks panhandling, which is entirely legal and constitutional, as you know. But now, with this new ordinance with the dogs, evidently there is a condition in there that you can't panhandle with the dogs. So it seems a bit contradictory, and Don pointed that out, and he did try to offer an amendment, but it was unfortunately didn't get the support it needed.
Well, what was the contradiction here?
Well, the contradiction is that you can't panhandle with an animal. But you can't tie your animal up anywhere downtown. So if you're panhandling downtown with an animal, then you're arguably in violation of the panhandling law. But you can't, even with the repeal or the temporary repeal of the dog ordinance, you can't tie your dog up anywhere and then panhandle.
Now, did Mayor Coonerty, who I imagine was chairing the meeting, allow 2 minutes or 3 minutes per speaker?
I think it was just two. But there were several speakers. And they just had the two-minute rule.
They had to what?
They had the two-minute rule, but really, most people didn't really exceed that. There were a couple of folks who had some additional things to say, but mostly it was about dog owners saying that they believe that they're responsible enough to pick up after the animals and that they wanted to be a more dog-friendly town. So that was basically the argument, and the city council agreed with that. And so there is now this pilot project for 3 months. I think will go into effect August, September, and October, where there will be the no dogs downtown ordinance will be held in abeyance for that period of time.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people, I among them, particularly based on reports I've heard over the years, who believe this ordinance was cooked up originally as a sort of an anti-hippie ordinance, having little to do with real health and safety problems or dog bites or even dog poo-poo downtown, although, you know, you get a different story sometimes from J.M. Brown or others, and particularly how it's been enforced over the years. Even, the ordinance came up for on the recommendation of the Downtown Association, I believe, as recently as April of last year, when they wanted to suspend the ordinance because people were pointing out that while homeless people were getting ticketed a lot, it was becoming they had to put up signs about no dogs on Pacific Avenue, and this was deterring the upper middle class tourists who would come to town with their poodles.
Yeah, well, that was the opinion of the Downtown Association, that Santa Cruz had gotten a reputation as being dog unfriendly. So evidently the Downtown Association, I guess by a majority vote, and not all the members of the Downtown Association did, were in support of this pilot project. But there were enough that were, that it was but for City Council for on this emergency basis. And so, you know, they had the hearing and the ordinance passed.
Now, according to the story in the paper, I think it's by J.M. Brown, Coonerty reportedly said, he's the mayor, people use dogs as a way to garner sympathy. We thought that this was an inappropriate use of an animal in this situation.
Well, I think that fairly characterizes what he intended to say.
And what's your reaction to this quote?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I think that's an unfair characterization of people who love animals and have them. And, you know, I think, you know, naturally, people, it doesn't matter who you are, if you're walking down the street with a cute animal, people can engender sympathy whether you ask them for money or not. So I think it's unfair to say that people are using animals in that way, exploiting them, let's say, just for the purposes of engendering more money from potential donees when you're downtown panhandling. I think it's unfair.
Are you contradicting our mayor?
Well, I'm just saying my opinion. I think that that's an unfair characterization. You know, he has his opinion, I have mine. We differ on a great many things.
So would you, were any other people in the audience concerned about this attempt to specify, quote, panhandlers not being allowed to have their dogs? Was there much discussion? Let me put this, was there much public testimony?
No, there was very little public testimony. Actually, it was Don Lane's own initiative to suggest this amendment to the proposed pilot project. So he just felt that it was unfair to panhandlers. So, and I really applaud his effort. Mm. How successful it was. I think his intentions were good.
And I think you and Becky Johnson, a local homeless activist, also felt the same way when she wrote something about having read in the paper his position, which, you know, I agree. It would have been nice also if, you know, he also took some other positions that might lead some consistency to his position. But, you know, I guess...
Well, I think in his recent history has been... But he's certainly supportive of social services. As you know, during the recent budget hearings, he's attempting to get a 3% cut on the community programs rather than 10%. And after quite a bit of time and effort to actually find the money to replace money that would have been fill the gap between 3% and 10%, that also was voted down by a 4-3 majority led by the mayor. So, you know, I think he is in those two occasions acting in, I think, the best interest of those folks who really need to be represented and protected, and often are not.
Now, you every Monday go to the homeless service, to the Calvary Episcopal, and between 5 and 7 offer legal assistance to folks based on your legal knowledge.
I do, and I'm also doing, as kind of a legal advocate for the Homeless Services Center, I am have participants from Page Smith and also from the Lovely Family Shelter and a couple from Paul Lee Roth. So, yeah, there's some folks who were talking about various things.
What are the issues that come up primarily for you?
Well, there's various things having to do with custody and visitation. When I was in law school, I clerked in a family law office and did some work with family law attorneys over the years, so I can kind of advise them in terms of what paperwork they may need to file. So we've had some of that.
Right, no, I understand that. But, I mean, what issues are – what are the problems that they're having that they're bringing to you?
Oh, I think there's just problems with significant others or with any kind of a governmental entity. It doesn't matter what it is. You know, if they seem unsatisfied with their situation and they ask if I can help them out in some way. And often if there's some legal aspect to it that I can't.
Well, what I'm saying is, are there particular forms of discrimination or police misconduct that seem to be?
I haven't had any of that yet. Although I'm certainly open to helping people who are having that kind of situation arise when they're, you know, attempting.
What have you had? I mean, what kind of issues have been coming up?
I haven't had any of that. As I say, mostly it's just been the garden variety, people having problems with some governmental entity or some kind of a relationship with a significant other. but I really haven't had anybody talk to me about dog tickets, for instance, or sit lie log tickets, for instance, or panhandling.
Or sleeping bag.
Or sleeping bag, although I would certainly be willing to help out people if they received those tickets and had any interest in actually taking those to court or, you know, doing something beyond just...
You're a man who speaks very quickly, Steve, and I want to make sure I understand you clearly. So the issues that have been brought up have been, again, I'm still not quite clear what... I know what happened, what issues haven't been brought up, and I wish...
Yeah.
But what has been brought up? What kind of issues?
Oh, well, just as I say, I mean, I can't tell you specifically because, you know, those kinds of things are confidential, even between non-lawyers and people who are just trying to help out, so I can't tell you that. But what I can tell you is that I'm open to helping out to anybody who has any kind of problems, particularly with the municipal ordinances, if they have any interest in fighting those or taking those to court, then I'm the person to talk to.
You know, I think that even lawyers with their clients don't mind saying what the issues are in a kind of a general sense. They just don't want to reveal their legal strategies.
Yes.
So I would encourage you with your next, when you next talk to your, you know, people who you're advising, ask them if they mind if you mention these things generally about, you know, being problems in the homeless community. I think you'd find they'd probably say sure, because
yeah,
that's what they say to me all the time, you know.
Well, and then when they say that to me, then I'll say that to you.
Good. I'm glad to hear it, because I think that's...
also, let me give you one report. I had a call from our good friend Ed Fry, and as you know, that he's going to be representing Robert Facer in your sing-song appeal, so he suggested that we get together for a little strategy session, and I told him that you and I, of course, will be meeting tomorrow to talk about your full-throated and stentorian appellate argument that will be happening next week.
I've already done a little downtown singing on the air and mentioned that there is an appeal hearing happening on Thursday the 21st at 4 o'clock in Department 3.
That's the date, and we will be there, and we'll be preparing for that tomorrow.
All right, and that I want you to know is not privileged information. You have my permission to sing that far and wide.
Well, maybe I'll do that as we go along the season.
Well, listen, anything else happening this week that you want to point out other than, of course, your lone Saturday vigil at noon, which you may or may not be doing?
Well, I'll probably be back doing that this Saturday. I've, you know, just been a lot of flyering for this festival Del Nopal. It's going to be happening at least on Sunday. And, of course, probably West Pool. I'm kind of trying to get that pushed through, and this is a critical time for that. You know, DSAL we had last night, and we're thinking about now forming a different organization to actually move to a referendum on a ballot measure in November 2012. So those things, you know, taking up my time. But anybody who's interested in that can call me at 334-8692, and I'd be happy to talk to them about it.
And again, so if people want some assistance, particularly on homeless issues, I think that's one of your fortes.
Absolutely.
At least that's what your card says, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Homeless Legal Assistance Project.
That's what it says.
334-8692. 334-8692. Talk to Steve Plaich, rhymes with H.
Oh, all right, Robert.
All right, see you tomorrow, Steve.
You bet. Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye. And is it just me, or does Steve seem to talk so damn fast you can't keep up with him? I have trouble hearing clearly what he's saying. Anyway, we're getting into the last 9 minutes of the show. For all you people who are feeling left out, you better call and get included in before it's too late, because it's going to be too late real quick. I had hoped also to get some folks discussing the smart meter protests in Capitola, which I haven't heard a call back from Marilyn Garrett or any of the other folks who were arrested or cited for that. But I believe that's been covered to some extent by people in other shows. On Tuesday evening, I believe there's a show by Coral and Free that covers a lot of these topics, 7 to 10, for those who are interested. I would encourage people to check that out. I was interested in reading that there was a protest that disrupted the BART services around the fatal shooting of a homeless man by a BART police officer. No, it wasn't Johannes Merzely capping Oscar Grant III. That happened 2 years ago, and Merzely got a very light sentence for that murder, as I would call it, though I guess the jury called it manslaughter. But this was a shooting... And let's see, do they actually mention the name of this victim? Looking in the Chronicle.
Charles Blair Hill, a 45-year-old transient who allegedly threw a bottle at two BART officers and pulled a knife before one officer shot him to death at the Civic Center platform. Protesters marched around the Civic Center platform shouting, "No justice, no peace." Some of the demonstrators then boarded a train and blocked a doorway for 10 minutes, preventing the train from leaving. Protesters yelled at and shoved BART security guards who tried to corral them. One man climbed on top of the train before security guards pulled him down. After the doorway was cleared and the train departed, BART ordered trains to not stop at the station. About two dozen BART police dressed in riot gear arrived shortly after 5 and herded the rest of the demonstrators out of the station with the help of San Francisco police officers. Commuters rushed to the Civic Center from the Civic Center to the nearby Powell Street station, which also had to be closed because of overcrowding. More than a dozen protesters reconvened. This is up in San Francisco, at the 16th Street Mission Station, where they also disrupted service. Johnson said, Johnson was a BART official, according to this story. As he spoke to reporters, several white protesters called Johnson, who is African-American, Uncle Tom, and a self-conflicted blackie. I wonder why they would do that. Although I guess the guy that was shot dead, Charles Blair Hill, I don't know what color he was, what his racial background was, but I know that it has always seemed to me that shooting someone dead for attacking you with a knife, well, it seems far too easy for police to get away with this kind of stuff. And I would wonder if it can be so easily justified if it were a private citizen doing it, particularly a poor person doing it to a rich person. I don't think that would so easily meet the criterion. Also, I believe Crow and Red, who are two homeless activists active in Peace Camp 2010, and also the protest that helped to free Ed Fry, and I'm coming in a little late on this, they were ticketed last night or the night before for sleeping outside in their vehicle, and they had no other place to go. I'm going to see if I can get a hold of Crow on the phone. It's possible that I can. Let's see if that's a doable thing. Let me actually try a line that might work here. Let's see here. We're coming up on the end of the show, so we're going to have to make this quick. And if we can't get him now, we'll contact him on Sunday when I come back do a longer edition of this show, assuming I'm not sensible enough to leave town and do something more meaningful with my time.
Hello.
Crow.
Yes.
You're on the air. Free Radio says hello.
Okay, excellent.
So we have about 3 minutes. You say that your slumbers were disturbed by certain questionable parties.
Yeah, this morning the cops came and wrote us a ticket for fucking sleeping in Santa Cruz.
Sleeping in Santa Cruz. You know that's a crime, Crow.
I know. I'm going to prison for the rest of my life because of it.
Well, now, how can you
do
this?
I'm on probation, so I guess I'm going to prison.
So you're a man who, you know, in spite of having been warned repeatedly about sleeping at night in Santa Cruz, you insist. Why don't you do what ordinary people do and sleep during the day instead of, you know, this ridiculous practice?
Well, it was 7 o'clock in the morning, so what's daylight?
I don't want to hear your excuses, Crow. That is
not
sufficient.
Now, wait a minute. The cops said that the neighborhood, the people in the neighborhood complained, okay?
There is no neighborhood.
Anyway, hello?
They complained. What were you doing? Were you urinating, beating a drum at 7 o'clock
in
the morning?
Oh, no, we were just laying in bed, sleeping in an RV.
Is there some sort of sex involved in this?
I'm going to have to give my dog a ticket.
Yeah, Red said to the cop, "Are you going to give my dog a ticket for sleeping?"
And what did the police officer say to that riposte?
Well, he kind of laughed a little bit. We finally got him to laugh.
He chuckled as he gave you a $97, and actually it costs more
these
days.
No, it's a $180 fucking ticket.
Really? That's interesting. They shouldn't be doing that because the municipal code is supposed to restrict that ticket, so we're going to have to investigate this. It could be the city is overstepping its authority.
We're going to have to restrict
them restricting us restrictors.
We have to meet in New Jersey.
So what do you plan to do with this citation? Are you going to challenge it in court? Are you going to get
attorney
Ed Fry?
I'm going to do what you told me to do, is go to the Coral Street shelter, which I just got kicked out of today.
Really?
Yeah, I got kicked out of there today because I was voicing my opinion about the first alarm, breathing down people's necks, and getting a ticket for camping. And five other people got tickets for camping that I talked to a person that I can't say his name, for today. It was a big camping ticket day.
So these were all camping tickets for this morning, this one day?
Yeah, separate incidences.
At five different places.
Five different places. Anyway, Red's trying to be funny. But
tell my dog both, joke.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to tell him the dog joke on air. Well, maybe I will. But no, you tell him the dog joke on air. Here, hold on.
No. I don't want to hear the dog joke at this time.
Yes,
sorry, Red. I'd have to. Let's do it on Sunday because we have the. I'm running up against the next show here. I've literally 10-9. I have very.
Yeah, hear the dog joke. It's quick.
It's really.
Give
funny
me the dog joke, but we're going to hear the dog.
If a dog barks to your fucking face today, it's another way to say hi.
I missed it. That was so fast, I missed it.
Okay. If a dog farts in your face, that's another way of saying hi.
That's a joke? I would say rather that is a bad odor, that particular joke.
It's supposed to be a joke.
So I gotta tell you, so you had
anyway.
Wait a minute, you got kicked out of the Homeless Service Center today when you attempted to get a letter, sign up on the
shoes.
You attempted to sign. Wait a minute. You attempted to sign up on the waiting list, and you also attempted to get a letter for indicating
they were
full.
No, I didn't do that. I was standing there with no shoes, waiting to go get food, and the guy said I couldn't get food if I didn't have shoes.
Did he offer to give you a pair of
shoes? And I said, if I walk on my hands and stand on my head, will that be qualified for me? And then the fucking first alarm guys came and threw me off the lot, and they attempted to get all my information down on their little pieces of paper.
Security number.
You know, and they wanted my social security number. And I told them to fuck off. You know, I'm not giving them my social security number. And they wanted to know my vehicle license plate number. They wanted to know this number, that number. And then the guy that's running the lot said that I'm out of there for 7 days. Like, I don't give a fuck. I don't need to be there, you know? And basically, I was trying to, when I was standing in line, tell everybody that this is bullshit. But I got thrown off the lot, and I left. And they asked me how much I had to drink, and I told them, like, 5 gallons of fucking alcohol. And the guy was, 5 gallons of alcohol? And I was like, obviously, that's a joke, you know? And they weren't in a fucking joking mood. So
about what time did this happen, Crow?
This happened at, I believe, 4:20, 4:30, around that time, standing in line.
So I think what we will
food.
Do is if you...
And then one guy caught.
Wait, I want to hear what Robert has
so
to say.
So I think what we want to do here is essentially come back with a delegation that has, you're trying to get, you know, necessary papers, you're trying to sign up, you're trying to get information.
No, I was just standing in line for fucking food.
Right, no,
I wasn't
but
even
I'm,
doing the
I understand,
fucking
but what,
thing yet.
I understand, but what we want and what you were trying to do,
is,
wait a minute, what you were trying
listen.
To do as well was you were trying to get evidence that the night that you were given a ticket, their shelter was full, right?
Yeah. Well, actually,
and that's what you have been able to get.
And okay. I can't go to the shelter with a dog.
Well, and you can't go to the shelter with a dog. Wait a minute. What about the doggy? Well, we'll have to get into that later. All right. So I'm gonna let you two go.
Yeah.
Because I
gotta
go,
go
myself.
Too.
I have a very tolerant.
Thank you for calling me. I really appreciate
here,
it,
but,
so I can vent.
Well, if you're constipated,
all right.
Anyway.
You're going in and out. What happened to you?
I'm here and you're there. That's probably
okay.
One of the problems.
Anyway, thank you, Robert. I love you. Keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you, guys. Keep up the...
All right.
And hang in there, Red, and hang in there, Crow.
Okay, he said hang in there.
All right.
My hair's growing back.
Her hair's growing back.
Fair enough. Talk to you later. And Crow is a longtime activist. He, as I said, for 2 weeks did a protest that eventually helped to free Ed Fry and Gary Johnson from the Huskow for the moment on appeal. And Anna Red, his partner, has cancer, and she's trying to survive in her van while being treated for cancer. So it's rough and tough, particularly when you're getting camping tickets and getting thrown out of the homeless service center that's supposed to be defending homeless people. But I guess in a way, that's kind of par for the course.